Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2005. This session is The Redemptive Self, Generativity and the Psychology of Adulthood, presented by Dan McAdams in the Creekside Room. Disc number MCD-2005-01. Let's listen in.
A few handouts here we may need to share if we run out. My parents were not especially well-churched, but my mother grew up in the Serbian Orthodox Church, and so I was baptized as a baby Serbian Orthodox, but never did attend church until about age six, and my brother and I were outside one Sunday morning just sort of playing and goofing off, as we did routinely, and the neighborhood Baptist church lady would just basically go down the streets in our neighborhood and pick up stray kids and take them to church, picked us up, and I remember it that she abducted us, actually, but my mother insists that she actually knocked on the door and asked if she might take Danny and Jeff to school, to church, and my mom was all for that. And so I ended up with the Baptists for a while. I got the last hand up. It's a lot of responsibility on you there. Actually, I do have three more, it turns out. Does anybody else need one? Grew up in the Baptist Church. It was a very important, positive, mainly positive influence for me. And then when I went to college, growing up in Indiana, I ended up going to Valparaiso University because I could get a state scholarship to go there. And met Lutherans, really, for the first time. And fell in love with a young Lutheran girl whose dad happened to be a minister, and so since then I've sort of been with the Lutherans. I had what the Baptists call, and it's in the Lutheran tradition to a certain extent, a personal conversion experience when I was in fourth or fifth grade, maybe sixth. They had this Bible class that you would go to, and at the end of the class, the teacher would ask, well, did anybody ask Jesus into his heart today? And, you know, usually nobody had done it. It's like a lot of silence. And even then, I was kind of like a professor to be, and I'm thinking, this is an awkward silence. Somebody should say something, right, to get it going. And so one day I did it. And so I said that I had accepted Jesus in my heart. It sounds a little flip, but it actually was a big turning point for me. And although I lied at that point, I did eventually come into the fold of the Baptist Church. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, this is supposed to be a dramatic turning point in your life. This is supposed to turn your story around. This is a theme I'm very interested in, people's stories and how they get turned around. And at the time, as a kid, thinking, you know, that wasn't so dramatic. You know, people said, oh, when you're saved, you know, everything changes. Nothing really seemed to change much, but now that I look back on it, I think it was sort of a symbolic turning point in some ways for my life story. We'll be talking about the symbolic turning points a lot. Anyway, met my wife, and I've been sort of in cahoots with the Lutherans ever since. And my wife and I, Rebecca Hallmeyer is her name, are members of Trinity Lutheran in Evanston, Illinois. As a professor of psychology at Northwestern, I do two things, basically. I teach and I write. Well, I teach and I do research and writing. I put the research and writing together. I am not a clinical psychologist. I do not help people with their problems. I have no expertise in therapy. I'm not trained that way. I'm trained as a researcher. But the kind of research I do is not what many people typically associate with research psychologists. You might think of running rats in mazes, or today a lot of it is brain research where they look into the brain, how the brain works with a certain sort of technologies. My research is not in that direction. It's more in the direction of how people make meaning in their lives, how they construe their lives as stories and what those stories mean. So I collect these stories and I analyze these stories as if they were like pieces of fiction. Like a literary critic might analyze them, because I sort of believe that they are, to a certain extent, fictional, in a positive way, as well as sometimes in a distorting way, and that these stories give us meaning and purpose. And so I kind of categorize stories, and I analyze people's life stories, and I relate them to certain themes, certain psychological issues. So, for example, people who are highly depressed, they have certain kinds of narratives. Very extroverted people have certain kinds of stories about their lives. People who have been through three religious traditions like me have certain kinds of stories. And I kind of categorize and classify stories and try to make sense of them psychologically and also in terms of what they say about culture. Well, the stories I've been interested in for the last 10 years revolve around the theme that is the organization for this collection of classes, and that's the theme of redemption. It's a theme that in the Christian traditions we know very well. It's associated with many things in our tradition. The word redemption has some secular meanings, too. That's often used in just everyday talk, even in sports. Will the Cardinals get redemption this year after not winning the World Series last year? That people talk that way about the term redemption. So when you look at redemption across religious and secular traditions, cross-culturally and so forth, you see that the basic psychological meaning of it is really twofold. You start with some sort of suffering, okay, and then you are delivered from the suffering to some enhanced status. In some cases, the enhanced status that follows the suffering is better than what you had going into it. Okay? Like no pain, no gain. I'll do this and I'll go through all this trouble and then I'll come out of it better than before. In other cases, it's more like the silver lining in the dark cloud. Something positive came out of that. In any case, I'm interested in the extent to which people's lives portray this theme. It's actually an interesting thing with respect to the Bible study this morning. In the case of Job, the story of Job, the question keeps popping in my head, and I don't know the story that well, but I'm going to keep attending and tune in. Is there redemption for Job? What does redemption mean in a story like that where the suffering is so total, and at least at the beginning of the chapter, it seems like the suffering is so senseless. Job didn't do anything to deserve a suffering, or at least that's one way to think about it. Now, to get us into this idea of redemption, let me ask if you look at the first, turn the page in your handout if you have one. If you don't, maybe you can move on. I want to just read the first couple of paragraphs here. This is from a book that I am writing. It will be out this fall. It's called The Redemptive Self, Stories Americans Live By. Let me just read it for you. The prologue here. Beginning September 11, 2001. William Langewisha spent 9 months at the site of the World Trade Center disaster. He observed and interviewed firefighters, construction workers, engineers, police officers, and paid volunteers who cleared the debris and dug through the rubble in search of survivors. Within hours of the collapse of the towers, as rescuers rushed in and resources were marshaled, Langewisha later wrote, the disaster was smothered in an exuberant and distinctively American embrace. The workers were convinced that something good would arise from the carnage. Despite the apocalyptic nature of this scene, Langewisha suggested, the response was unhesitant and almost childishly optimistic. It was simply understood that you would find survivors, and then that you would find the dead, and that this would help their families to get on with their lives, and that your resources were unlimited, and that you would work night and day to clean up the mess, and that this would allow the world's greatest city to rebuild quickly, and maybe even to make itself into something better than before. Or, put differently as I write here, it was simply understood that there would be redemption. Now, Langewisha is a journalist here. He spent 9 months at the site of the World Trade Center disaster, and what he is struck by is the optimism, the exuberant expectation on the part of the workers that, this was terrible. Almost 3,000 people died, and it was a blow to our national pride and so many other things, and what a terrifying and terrible incident. But something good is going to come out of this, right? We'll rebuild it. It'll be better than it was before. And the world's greatest city, New York, how could there be a greater one, right? Will rise from the ashes and will attain a higher status than it was. And Langewisha is mainly admiring this. He's mainly admiring this, but he's also a little bit taken back because there's something almost childish about it, too. Something almost like over the top, maybe a little naive, and yet deeply deeply inspiring at the same time. Now, what I want to argue this week is that some people's life stories, the stories they construct about their lives, are like this. Okay? Not that they go through something necessarily as horrific as 9/11, although we all have our own personal tragedies that that are very, very painful to us. But that many people see their lives as these opportunities for redemption. And so I'll go through a period in my life where there's a lot of suffering, and then I'll turn it around. Something positive will come out of that. Some people tell their life stories that way, one redemptive scene after another. Other people don't so much. There's lots of different ways to tell your life story. Tuesday, we're going to talk a bit about how to tell your life story, what kinds of life stories get told. We'll do a little bit of it here. There's a zillion ways to tell your narrative about your life. Some people zero in on this theme of redemption quite a bit. And in my research, the studies I've done, the people who do this the most tend to be midlife, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes early 60s, although it could happen anytime. Midlife adults who are especially caring and productive. Many of the most, in my mind, most admirable people in our society, who are the movers and the shakers, the teachers, the mentors, the leaders, the parents who are really invested in their kids' education, these highly caring and productive adults in the prime of their lives, in these middle adult years, tend to be more likely than the rest of us to tell life stories that accentuate this theme of redemption. So I want to begin today, I'm going to spend most of the time today considering these kinds of people. I've got a word for them, it's not my word. It comes from the writings of Eric Erickson, a psychologist. Many of you may know his writings. He uses the word generativity to talk about being very caring and productive in your midlife years. So on the next page of your handout, we have here the word generativity, and that's a photo there of Eric Erickson and his wife Joan. I mean, just, you know, I don't know the room. How many know Eric Erickson's name? I mean, is it a lot of you? Okay, more than half. All right. Are familiar with the name Eric Erickson, maybe know quite a bit about him. Psychoanalytic theorist of the 20th century. He passed away a little over 10 years ago. And his big breakout book, which I think he wrote over and over again. But it was a great book, and you get it right the first time. It was called Childhood in Society. He also wrote a wonderful biography, an interesting, controversial, psychological biography of Luther, young man Luther, which is actually the first thing I ever read by Erickson. But Childhood and Society in 1950 is the book that most people go back to again and again, and it's in that book that he defines this term generativity. Now, I got Joan's picture in there with him. Joan and Eric Erickson were quite a team, it turns out, and there have been biographies written recently, one in particular, from a professor in Indiana who claims that a lot of the ideas were Joan's. Not that Eric stole them necessarily, but you know, they were really a team, okay? You know, he, of course, was the one who got the authorship credit. There is some indication that Joan was quite instrumental in many of the ideas, and in particular this one, this idea of generativity, and there is some thought that she actually kind of invented the word, although the word does exist independent of Erickson's theory, but it's used in many other contexts. So generativity is an adult's concern for or commitment to promoting the well-being of future generations. Right? It's a very broad idea. Your commitment to, your concern for promoting the well-being of future generations. And there's lots of ways to do this. And so I wanted to take a little time today to sort of consider ways in which people are generous. Okay, and the different ways in particular. There are some obvious ways, and there are some ways that perhaps aren't so obvious. And so this is my first question to you. Okay, what are the different ways in your life or in the lives of people you admire, perhaps, that you see adults being generative?
Being mindful of the environmental impact.
So being mindful of the environmental impact. And why, how is that generative?
In the sense that they're leaving, hoping to leave a positive environment for future generations.
Yeah, right. So we're here on this planet. It's got finite resources, right? We need to pass it on to the next next generation. This theme of passing it on is really key to generativity. So what do we do with this world that we're given? Well, we can, you know, pollute it and destroy it and, you know, kind of run roughshod over it, or we can try to conserve it and hold on to it and maybe improve it in a way that can be passed on. So that's a very important way to be about, to talk about generativity, and probably a way that 100 years ago not too many people talked about. Right? I mean, generativity is not one of these ideas that is like universally understood the same way. Every culture defines it differently, and today, in 2005 in the United States, especially at a place like Holden, where we are so environmentally conscious, this would be a very important way to think about generativity. What's it otherwise?
100 years ago, we didn't need a place like Holden to tell us to look out for things. We just did it. Yeah. Now we have to have a special place to draw our attention to it.
That's true. So now it becomes a generativity problem, where it wasn't, as you pointed out 100 years ago. It's a new challenge, a new problem. Yeah. Other ways that we can be generative,
Working for justice.
Working for justice, yeah.
And that's internationally through peace efforts, that's locally through economic justice, social justice.
Okay, and that's generative in what way?
So that you have a better world in the future.
Leading a better world in the future, okay. All right. For our children?
You mentioned 100 years ago. 100 years ago, there was so much here that people didn't feel they could ever be an end for it. So they cut timber, and they weren't aware of pollution techniques. They weren't aware of the microorganisms and things like that. It's the lack of awareness.
That's a good point.
Otherwise, they may have been more careful.
Well, I think it raises something for generativity, too. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, we don't think about generativity unless there's some sort of limit on you know, unless there's some sort of constraint. And so if, you know, if we were, for example, if we were going to live forever and our children were going to live forever, I mean, well, maybe we wouldn't be so concerned about, you know, like investing the resources in promoting their well-being because, after all, they're taken care of. Okay? Well, in the same sense, you know, but maybe 100 years ago, we felt that the world was taken care of. You know, we don't have to worry about it. The resources are limitless, and now we understand that we understand it differently than we did before.
There are a lot of coaching and mentoring communities, volunteers,
coaching,
all over the country.
Yeah, people do a lot of that as midlife adults, sports coaching, encouraging children to develop their potential. Other ways that we're generative. Yeah, Britt.
The name of Holden's present capital campaign is From Generation to Generation.
So raising money.
But just being really aware that a place like this is very fragile, and that, you know, if those of us who have benefited from it in the past are going to be able to pass it on, it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of money, and it takes a lot of thought and collaboration with others, even when it's difficult.
Well, you know, you talk about the fragility, and it kind of relates to this lady's theme here, and that is, you know, when something is precious and yet easily hurt, like a baby, like a child. Okay, we need to nurture it, we need to care for it, and in this case, you know, raising money is one very important way to pass good things on for the next generation. Not just a place like Holden, but I mean, like a place like Northwestern University. All right, we have a capital campaign going. It's gazillions of dollars. I don't know who these rich people are, but they got lots of money, and they're, you know, funding and endowing chairs and new buildings and so forth. And it's generativity. They believe in the mission of the university. They feel that this is a good way for them to invest in the future. Okay, so you can get into the language of investment here. It's got sort of a financial sound to it. It's very different than the language of ecology, and yet it seems that it can connect to generativity. Paying your taxes, I guess, can be seen as a generative thing, right? You're, ideally, the money should be used for providing for the next generation. It's not always used that way, perhaps. Other ways,
Writing and art.
Writing and art. I'm glad you brought that up, because that takes us in a different direction. And why did you say that?
To get words and ideas on paper that will hopefully last to the next generation.
So there's this creativity aspect of generativity, okay? Creating something through art, through crafts, through scientific discovery, perhaps, through relationships, because some people are creative. Just one was talking about creative loitering, right? I mean, where is she? Oh, there you are. That was your term, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, creative loitering. Yeah. It's not your company?
I did not invent the notes. It comes from campus ministry. It's a way of doing
Well, take credit
ministry.
For it. No, you should take credit for yourself.
I'm Canadian. I can't do that.
Are you Canadian?
No,
you can't
but
do that.
Dan, that just highlights campus ministry as sort of an ultimate form of generativity.
Yeah, certainly is. Certainly is. Well, I was thinking about the Canadian forms of generativity, being sort of softer and gentler than
American forms, perhaps.
But okay, the creativity aspect of generativity is very important. And we make things, and we hope that they will have some positive impact. Now, you know, sometimes, a lot of times they don't. I mean, you know, some people create for creation's sake, and they'll say, well, I'm intrinsically motivated to make something beautiful, and if nobody ever sees it, fine. But I think, deep down, they kind of want somebody to see it, at least. Or maybe they think God sees it. Maybe God's the ultimate audience here or something. But, there is that aspect of generativity to it. And that aspect, sometimes is, Canadians aside, okay, can be a bit narcissistic. I think in a good way. I'm going to actually argue that generativity has a narcissistic component to it, as well as an altruistic component to it, which is one of the reasons I like generativity as a concept. It's complicated. It's not an easy call that generativity is always good, okay? People invest themselves in the next generation. Okay? But they don't do it in a kind of egalitarian, the next generation in general. Okay, they prioritize. They prioritize things that matter to them. They're my children. Okay, I'll take care of my children first, and then I'll help others. But, my children. Okay, now, not everybody does it that way, but many do. There is this sense that generativity is a little bit about me. And maybe that's necessary for it to have a power to summon up the resources to care for the next generation. It's I'm coaching my team. I'm funding my university. I'm sending the money to Holden because Holden is my place, or it's a place that I belong to and feel part of. So there's a little edginess sometimes in generativity that I actually kind of like. I think it's a more interesting concept than maybe just plain straight out self-sacrifice, okay? Which is obviously a very noble concept. But I don't think generativity is so much advice. There's a piece of that, but there's also a self-promotional piece. And not just in art, but in raising children and coaching and many of the other ways as well.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I think you had a hand up before, then I'll get you. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to say this really clearly. But how do you differentiate between generativity in a positive way of someone being a loving, caring person that cares what they do versus the really unhealthy kind of codependent kind of thing? If there's one thing I've ever felt was a red flag that I'm on the wrong turf doing the wrong thing, it's when I'm sitting here trying to influence someone else and I'm really caring about how they're going to react to me. Anytime I find myself thinking, what will so-and-so think? How can I, make them like me or get them to see the value of this? I usually see that as a real negative.
Well, it's a problem in generativity. There's lots of actual problems in generativity. I thought you were going to raise one. You raised a different one than I predicted, but this is a really good one, too. And this is the problem maybe sometimes of letting go. Okay, you want to care for the next generation. You want to provide something. And the next generation says, forget you. I don't need this. Mm-hmm. Or you're suffocating me with your care, okay? So I think there are many examples, you use the term codependency, I believe. There are many examples in life where our best generative efforts maybe go awry, okay? I don't think it's easy. In fact, I would say it's impossible to step back and objectively say, that's good generativity over there. That's unhealthy generativity over there. Nonetheless, we do make some judgments. We have to make some kind of judgments.
I just know the people that truly meant the most to me and influenced me were the ones I felt were free of that.
Mm-hmm.
Would never be the ones I felt were had their own agenda to try to pass on some generative thing. They've given people who did what they did because it seemed like their authentic way of being and loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like they weren't trying to manipulate me and weren't trying to pass on some particular agenda.
Were they trying to pass on anything?
Well, they weren't attached. attached to what the results were going to be. They didn't have their heart set on converting me in some way. There was a matter of which they were doing it totally out of their own integrity and joy, and they weren't all hung up on whether I was going to get it or not. You know what I mean?
But you got it. You got something out of it.
I never
gotten it from
the people who were intentionally doing it. I've always gotten it as a side effect, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. It's an interesting way to think about generativity. I think people, the word intentional is tricky here, okay? I mean, you know, to what extent do we intend? I do think you're right in the sense that, you know, some people come on too strong and they have an agenda, okay? I want you to believe this, I want you to do this, and so forth. And other people have a softer touch and they have less of an agenda. Yet at some level, I think they're about the business of, if nothing else, being a light unto others. And so, you know, here I am, and, you know, I'd love to be of use to you, but, you know, they're not, there's nothing desperate and grasping about it. And it sounds like that's the kind of generativity that you prefer. But I know a lot of young people, teenagers, who they don't want that kind of generativity, okay? They want someone to tell them what to do at this point in their lives, because they don't know. And so a heavy-handed, authoritarian coach might be the right thing for them at that time. Wouldn't be the right thing for me, might not be the right thing for you right now, and maybe it never in your life or mine, but I do think there is something to be said for the idea that, you know, there are these different sort of flavorings of generativity, and the context partly determines the extent to which we think they're good or not. But it's a really good question. You had one before.
Well, I mean, parenting is here, but it's kind of obvious just to create the generation, but I think now it's more or less a choice for many people, the decision to generate. There's a, I can't remind you, because I just bought a card in the bookstore. It says, a baby is God's opinion that the world should go on. And, you know, I mean, and now that's the decision.
So even that decision, I mean, becomes a generation. John Cotry, who's a psychologist who's written a lot about generativity, actually distinguishes among four different types, and you folks have sort of brought these up. Maybe I'll throw these up on the board real quick here. He talks about, first of all, the biological generativity. What, in your name, I'm sorry, is
Esther.
The Esther's, okay, example. I mean, this is basically, you know, conceiving the next generation, the actual act of conception and then gestation, and, I mean, that's very biological and it's fundamental. You are creating, quite literally, the next generation, okay? And then you have parental forms of generativity. I mean, you can make a baby, but you have to nurture and care for. And perhaps you can do it on your own, or perhaps it takes a village, or whatever, but there is this sense that children are dependent, they are precious, like Holden, okay? You can't just let it go, all right? You gotta invest in this product. Care for it, her, him, and nurture, grow, provide instruction, also encourage individuality and, you know, whatever cultural values you believe are important. There are technical forms of generativity that Kircher talks about, right? Teaching skills of various kinds. I taught my daughter recently how to keep score at a baseball game. At Wrigley Field, something my dad taught me, all right? I felt really good about that. Is this an important skill? Probably not. I think she'll be fine in life without it, but for me, it was a real generative moment. Plus, one of the few times she actually thought I had something, you know? Worth knowing. It's my older daughter, Rick, and she's been in my classes, and she says, oh my God, you're going to do the story thing again and hold it? Oh, they're going to hate it. She's heard this gig a few times. And then there are cultural forms of generativity, which involve passing on values, teaching and mentoring the mind and so forth. And these sort of blend into each other. I don't think there's anything profound about these four types. But I can hear those types in the things you're saying. There's also sort of like a sequence of generativity, you might say. Often generativity begins with creating something, but there's also the issue of maintaining.
here I think the Holden example is actually the better one for that. I mean, Holden is here, and it's now it's continually being recreated, you might say. But there's a lot of generativity that involves just keeping things going, all right? You know, paying the bills to keep things moving. Forget about improving. Let's just, like, make sure we can get everything okay. Let's pass down those things from one generation to the next. Let's hold on to the world's resources. We're not going to get more of them, so we need to maintain the status quo. You know, the status quo is pretty good. You need to keep what you've got. And then there's also this issue that is problematic, I think, of letting go of that which you've created or maintained. It's an especially difficult problem for parents, but I think actually it runs across many different forms of generativity. Okay, so I cared for this child, I brought this child into the world, sooner or later I had to figure out a way to let go, but not so that I'm absent from her life, but still to let go enough so that she can then move forward in life and become her own generative agent with her own life story and so forth. And how do you do that? It's a big problem in the lives of highly generative adults who are used, for the most part, used to having a fair amount of influence, and then they have to kind of learn to back off with respect to that. I think there's actually kind of a lot of examples of that. Problems and letting go, and or problems that when your offspring do things that you don't sort of approve of, and so now how do you rein them back in, or can you rein them back in, or should you rein them back in, and so forth. I mean, in a weird way, it's kind of like the creation story itself, okay, where God creates humankind in his or her own image, right? It's not like God said, I'm just going to make something, okay? It's like I'm making something that in some way is like me, right? In my own image. And yet at the same time, there's a kind of letting go, right? In the creation story, the first humans are granted a fair amount of autonomy. They're told not to do a couple things, but basically they've got free reign of the garden. Things go awry. They turn on God, in a sense, disobedience and so forth. And it's kind of a model, in a way, of the potential and the problems of generativity. The things that you create, be they living legacies like children, or be it something like the family business, or you donated money to that cause and then they turned and used it in a way you don't like, or you coached that team and the parents on the team didn't appreciate it. Lots of things can go wrong in generativity. It's not all sweetness and light, but I'm kind of interested in some of the frustrations that come in generativity. King Lear, there's a great quote in Shakespeare. King Lear says, nothing is sharp. As sharp as a serpent's tooth is the ingratitude of a child, or something like that. But then, you know, problems in generativity help to lead him to madness. And indeed, generativity has this sort of scary aspect to it. Yeah, it's Paul, right?
Yeah. I'm wondering if, in your studies, if you found that people who pass on, I think what we've talked about here, kind of positive things, have been less deliberate about it than people who pass on, I'm thinking of people like white supremacists, or who are really careful and deliberate about passing on their values. Yeah. That's a question, though. Is that true?
We don't have research on it, on that. It's very difficult to distinguish between passing on good things and passing on bad things. Not to be too much of a cultural relativist here, but from the standpoint of the white supremacists, they think they're doing generativity, some of them at least. Culture decides, and perhaps is guided by some universal instincts here, what constitutes positive and negative contributions. In our research, most of the people who, it's a nice segue to the next section here, most of the people we study who score high on our measures of generativity are passing on things that most people in the room would agree are really positive things. But we don't have in our studies white supremacists. This is sort of an unknown. These groups,
I have not been stuck in the same
thought. I just thought that Martin Luther King says that people of ill will use their time better than people of good will.
Well, there are some very efficient people of ill will.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I've always interpreted King Lear as the perfect example of someone who tried to be generative in all the wrong ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who valued gratitude too much, gave his legacy to the wrong donors, didn't appreciate the one who truly loved him just because she didn't step up to him and say the right stuff. I mean, that's the whole tragedy, is King Lear tried to be generative and he totally blew it.
Yeah, he did. But I think there are a lot of people who try to be generative and don't totally blow it, and things get totally blown. Do you know? Can you blame the parents of Timothy McVeigh, for example, or the suicide bombers who brought down 9/11? Can we actually say that their generativity wasn't good? Because we really don't know. And I think one of the things about generativity that I find fascinating is how it's really, you have no choice. You've got to be generative. But it's such a leap of faith because you don't know what the results down the road will be. Okay. I mean, it would have been better had Hitler's mother never conceived of that child. I think most people would agree. Yet,
somebody could have
it was a generative act. Pardon me?
Somebody could have shot him in World War I.
And that might have been a generative act. Yeah. There's actually a concept like that in generative literature called buffering. When you say, one way to be generative is to say, okay, instead of passing on the damage that I've, because you know, generative is about passing on, instead of passing on the damage that I and the bad things that have been given to me, I'm going to say it stops here. I'm the buffer for the next generation. My parents were terrible to me. They abused me. I'm going to be the perfect parent. I'm going to be a good parent. I'm going to turn it around. Those kinds of generative commitments can be very powerful. In a way, what they're not about passing it on. They're about saying the buck stops here. I'm not going to pass that on. I'm going to start a new tradition. That's all. Yeah.
On this parenting, if generativity is a life stage that people begin working on around in their 40s, especially in their 50s, then most people's children are already older by that time.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that a lot of generativity doesn't get worked out through parenting.
Oh, yeah.
But the later life parent... is more likely to be there. Now it takes two to tango, though. And if the later life parent is, or a parent is trying to work on generativity with a child, the child is egocentric. The child isn't thinking about how to make the world a better place.
Right, right. Children don't have a generative sense, right?
Some people try to work with their children on helping that child be individually successful, which is about benefit to the child, not necessarily making the world a better place.
True.
Right?
There's a difference in scope that I think you're relating to. And actually, we'll segue into it in a sec. The highly generative people that I study have a very broad scope of their generativity. They pretty much follow the sort of implicit ethic of what you're suggesting. And then she's going to go creatively loiter somewhere. they see their commitment to providing for the next generation to be broader than what they're doing with their children. And I think you're right in the sense that sometimes we don't reach our peak of our generative potential until our children are grown.
Because generativity is not just about our children, but sort of the seventh generation notion.
Well,
children,
ideally.
And the children's impact on making the world better for those after and those after and those after.
I'm totally with you.
Okay.
I don't know if everybody out there thinks about it that way necessarily. I mean, sometimes, you know, there's breadth of generativity, like Gandhi, okay,
mm-hmm.
His children were his nation.
Mm-hmm.
He was a terrible father.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Gandhi's truth, so there's an interesting trade-off there. He was a great father for his country. And then there's the long term, okay? So are you just trying to make America safe for the next couple of years? Or are you thinking 50 years down the road, or seven generations, as you point out? And I think we admire people who have breadth and depth of generativity. But yeah, this is a very important dimension when it comes to generativity. Let's talk a little bit about some highly generative people. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, this may be you can't judge.
That's okay.
I'm kind of stuck on this ill will versus good will
mm-hmm.
question. And, you talked about an assessment tool of some kind you have for generativity. And I'm trying to imagine how one would go about designing such a tool that would be relatively free of cultural bias or value judgment.
Why does it need to be relatively free?
Well, I don't know. I'm just looking for a little discussion around that question.
Well, let's look at the tool. All right, one of them. We'll go 2 pages ahead in the handout. So selected items from the LGS. Now, you know, when psychologists like me have tools, it's embarrassing compared to the kind of tools that the natural scientists over here, like Grant, who studies DNA and so forth, what they have, you know. Our tools are these sort of questionnaires, and interview protocols, and so forth. But there is actually some science involved in art in developing them. Eric Erickson argued that people become more generative in their midlife years in general, but he also said that there are strong individual differences, which I think is what we're getting at to a certain extent, in generativity. Some people are more generative than others, okay? It's not equal out there. And some people are more generative at certain times in their lives than others. You know, maybe in your 20s and 30s you weren't particularly generative, okay? Except in some small ways. And then, like, you hit your generativity stride in your 40s and 50s. And then maybe now in your 60s you're going to back off on generativity a little bit. You're going to move on to other things. I mean, it's not something that you can necessarily do across the life course. So people differ on this. And as a personality psychologist, that's really my main background, we essentially, the main thing we do is measure individual differences in personality characteristics. And generativity is one of those personality characteristics. But it's a personality characteristic. It's not like a trait that's with you forever. Okay, there are traits like that, by the way, like extroversion, for example. If you're a highly extroverted person at age 18, you can go to the bank on it. Probably 50 years later, you'll still be a pretty extroverted person. And some change, not much. Generativity is nothing like that. Up and down, it changes over time. It depends on life circumstances. It depends on culture, okay? And the cultural norms for generativity. So at any given point, if you take a slice of human beings, population, and you can assess individual differences in generativity through measures that have items like these little ones, granted, they're not all that profound, on this page. So,
LGS stands
the Loyola Generativity Scale. I used to teach at Loyola University, and my students and I developed a scale. It has about 20 items on it. These are just 5 of them. There's a lot of other kinds of measures, too, but this will give you a flavor of what this stuff is like. So you give people these kinds of items, and like, okay, I try to pass along knowledge I have gained through my experiences. All right? On a 1 to 4 scale, do you do that much? Okay. 4 means, yeah, I do that all the time, man. That's me. Okay, I am always passing along knowledge that I gave you my experience. 1 is, yeah, I'll do that very much. Okay, very early. 2 is sometimes, 3 is often, or it's something like that. You get the drill. I mean, it's one of these. This is not precision science here. These are just estimates that people make about their lives. And there's lots of different items. Any given item may lack validity, but when you add them up, they actually do predict things. I think I will be remembered for a long time after I die. That's an interesting idea. Okay? Doesn't sound very caring there, but it gets at that aspect of generativity that involves enduring impact, which is part of the concept. If I were unable to have children of my own, I would adopt children. That's a totally culturally loaded item to use to get it right. In some societies, they don't do adoption. Adoption, by the way, tends to be kind of white middle class. Okay? Most of my samples are white middle class, but not all. I've done a significant amount of research in the African-American community with working class and middle class African-Americans. But there is a cultural bias to some of these items. It's really impossible to design an interesting personality measure that doesn't encapsulate culture, because culture helps to define the concepts. So this particular scale might not work in Japan. You have to have different items. Okay? For example, in Japan, there isn't the tradition of doing volunteer work that we have here. Okay? That's not a big generativity thing. They do other kinds of generativity things. Right? So there's often a cultural thing. In general, my actions do not have a positive effect on others. Well, that's a reverse item. So if you put a 4 down, that's low generativity. If you put a 1, that's high. You just add up the items. There's about 20 of them, as I say. And of course, people lie on these things a little bit. Everybody rounds up. Yeah, I did pass on knowledge. It was like 10 years ago, I remember. Okay, somebody asked me for directions. Pretty paltry. But so people do round up a bit. But there are individual differences. The possible scores in this scale go from about 15 to 60. The average is about 40. Standard deviation, I don't remember, but it doesn't matter because you're not going to get a test on this. I don't remember what the standard deviation is statistically, but there's a spread, okay? And so, you know, people, some people score at the high end, it's like a normal distribution of bell-shaped curve. Some people score at the high end, some people score at the low end. A lot of people are in the middle. Gender differences, very few. Men, women score a little higher sometimes, but not dramatic.
The adoption thing you say is mostly white middle class thing, but other countries have something very close to adoption.
Right.
It's just a different pattern.
Different patterns, yeah.
I was
but I think the words I'm using.
Yeah, I was familiar with a culture where if one sister had several children, her sister didn't get any children fairly soon, she would give her sister one of her children. Now, they would probably live in the same village and they still were sharing the children anyway. So but that was the equivalent
concept, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think if you use the scale, then in that kind of a culture, you'd need to change the wording to to get that across.
You know, there wouldn't be anything on paper, and the child would know who her natural mother was and who her. But she'd call them both mothers.
Gotcha. So let's talk about people who score high on this measure. Measures like this. There are other measures, too. Here's another example of a measure. We can do this one, but we don't have time. I'm going to ask you, okay, what are the 20 things you're trying to accomplish these days? 20 big goals. Well, we usually ask for 10. 10 or 20 big goals over the line. Or actually, they don't have to be big goals, they can be little goals too. Like, you know, I'm trying to lose weight, okay? I'm trying to improve my, a lot of self-improvement stuff. I'm trying to, my goal handicap, thank you, that's a project. All right? I'm trying to get my kids through college. It sounds like generativity a little bit. I'm working on, teaching the kids in my neighborhood how to play baseball. That's a challenge. I'm donating money and working on a political campaign. That's a generative project, regardless of who you're voting for. Okay. I gave this talk in the early not this talk. I used to talk about generativity in the early 90s, and mostly pretty academic audiences, maybe pretty liberal political. And so somebody raises their hand, was it possible for a Republican to be generative? Now, I was talking about generativity to the JCs and Evanston last year, and I got the other side. Can Democrats be generative? We actually looked at this, Democrats and Republicans, equally generative in our data. But they have different visions. I know it's hard for you. Okay, what are people who are high in generativity like? Let's go to that last page of the handout. All right. Psychologists like me, we do a lot of research that sometimes gets at questions that are sort of obvious and we go, of course, but until you actually show it empirically with data, you really can't make a strong scientific case. So there are lots of studies that have been done using measures like the LGS to examine individual differences in generativity. And some of these things will be not surprising, but it is good to know that the particular questionnaire does predict these things. So, for example, Kathy Nakagawa, back in 1991, a student of ours at Northwestern, did a very interesting study of Chicago school reform. She had 300-plus parents of kids in the Chicago school system. And she had this long questionnaire protocol where she asked them things, all kinds of things, but included in there was an index of parental involvement in the schools. And that included things like, well, you know, do you know the names of your kids' teachers? Do you help your kids with their homework? Do you set aside time for homework? Do you go to the PTA meetings? That kind of stuff, all right? And then they try to predict that index of generativity, that index of parental involvement based on a lot of other measures. Well, there's all kinds of measures they had in the study to make a long and, to me, fascinating, to you, boring, I think, story short. Generativity was the only psychological variable that predicted those kinds of things. Highly generative adults are more involved in their parents' education. This is after you control for class differences, income differences. You know, it turns out middle-class parents are more involved than working-class parents. You can look at race differences there. There aren't too many, but you can control for those as well. Nonetheless, generativity is a strong predictor of being involved in your parents' and your kids'
it's associated with what's called an authoritative parenting style. There's a huge literature on this in psychology, like 50 years of research. God knows how much money has been spent to like figure out what's the best way to raise kids in terms of overall styles. And the general consensus, I'm not wild about it, the general consensus is that the best kind of parenting combines standards. You know, standards like, you know, this household has standards, okay? You do homework once, I don't know, whenever. And, but at the same time, it's warm and caring. And so an authoritative parenting style is parents who are very involved in their kids, a little bit controlling, but at the same time, very warm and child-centered. Those kinds of parenting styles have been associated with lots of positive outcomes in kids. Generativity predicts that. Highly generative adults tend to have that kind of parenting style. It goes outside of parenting. Religious involvement, political participation, and volunteer work. In our research, generativity is positively associated with being involved in some kind of religious tradition. I think it's really interesting. It doesn't matter what tradition, really. It wasn't something we predicted. And by the way, there are lots of non-religious people who are highly generative. But there is a statistical association here. And I think it suggests something that, you know, people of faith sort of know, but maybe never quite appreciate, that, you know, one of the benefits of being within a faith tradition is, you know, the emphasis on passing things on from one generation to the next and seeing life as precious and caring for it. And of course, you can do that outside of the religious tradition, but I think a religious tradition really makes it easier, helps and enhances generativity. Political participation. Highly generative adults, they vote more often. They're involved in local politics as well as national politics. They can vote conservative or liberal, Democrat, Republican, but they do vote. They do more volunteer work. They give time and money to organizations. They have broader friendship networks. There are lots of good things that come with generativity. Good things for others, for the most part, but also some good things for the self. People high in generativity on our measures also report and are rated by psychologists as happier a little bit. They see their lives as having more coherence and meaning. People low in generativity tend to score a little bit higher on measures of depression and anxiety. It's not a huge problem, but it is a difference. And so although generativity isn't like the road to fulfillment and happiness in life, there are many ways to have fulfillment and happiness, it's associated with some positive attributes. So the question that I want to get right at the end here, and then this will get us to our next to the next meeting I do, and I hope you folks can join me for it, and that is, okay, let's think about the generativity superstars, okay? And probably there's a lot of them in the world. And I mean, I'm not being totally serious, except I think that this is by no means a random sample of Americans, young adults, midlife and older. It's a fairly select group. And so when I think about generative people, I think often about people like the people in this room, who are committed to promoting the well-being of future generations in their own ways. We all do generativity differently, okay? And so let's think of some people that, you know, beyond ourselves, who you see as the great generativity superstars that you have known. I apologize for the sports metaphor that makes generativity sound triumphalist, and I don't mean it that way. Those people you deeply admire for those their generative commitments. You talked a little bit about some people in your life that you admire that particular way. And think about what kind of lives these people have led, and in particular, what kinds of stories they might create for their lives if they were asked to tell a story about their lives. And then let's imagine at the other end of the continuum, some less generative adults. If you ever took introductory psychology, you learn about experimental group and control group. Okay, you got the control group is the group you compare your findings to. Okay, so we want to compare the life stories told by highly generative to the kinds of life stories that are told by, you know, people who are sort of not that generative. What are the differences in those life stories? So I just got a minute or two, a few minutes left. Maybe I could just ask you folks to think about a moment, you know, who are some of the people that you most admire? We don't need names, but people you most admire for their generativity, and, you know, what might the story of their life be if they told it? Of course, you don't know. Any thoughts on that?
One public figure that
Jimmy Carter comes up a lot.
Yeah.
And why do you say that?
What he chose to do with his time after being president, getting in and working with Habitat and Auntie and things that he obviously really cared about how the world was going to be.
And if Jimmy Carter, if Jimmy Carter would be willing to sit down with me and tell me his life story, according to an interview protocol that I'll describe Tuesday, what do you think, how do you think he'd tell his life? What would he say? It's pure speculation, nobody knows.
He's going to go back to his old mother.
He's going to go back to his mother?
Yeah.
Okay. In Plains, Georgia.
She was as a Peace Corps worker when she was in her 70s somewhere.
Good. So she's a mob.
So she's probably one of the problems, at least.
Good. Yeah, good. So that's like a hypothesis you're forming. They're sort of suggesting, well, maybe a theme that comes up in the life stories of Heidi Johnson, adults like Jimmy Carter, is having early on some sort of really positive role model who personifies the generative life. Now, we don't know if that's the way it turns out, but that seems like a reasonable hypothesis.
Well, he has written numerous
autobiographies. Well, we could test it.
I think the first thing I thought was Nelson Mandela, coming from a completely different kind of motivation. No, not role model in his life, because he was 7 years in prison, but gives up everything to lead the country out of the race.
And how do you think he tells? Wasn't he a boxer when he was young?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So maybe he's a porn fighter. But he's seen incredible injustice and wants that change. So maybe out of the beginning comes his
The incredible injustice is a key theme, actually. We'll turn out. We'll talk about it next time. Highly generative adults are much more likely than the rest of us to tell you about early memories in their lives in which they witnessed injustice of some kind. And they'll throw it into the interview in weird ways. I mean, like, you're not expecting this, okay? But you'll see when we do the interview, if you're here, that, we ask these kind of general questions. Tell us about an early memory, okay? A lot of times about an early memory. Okay, I remember this. There was this retarded kid on our street. We used to beat him up. And I always felt bad about that. Why are you telling me this? Okay. Or, I was a young white boy attending a, this one comes from my life story, a Baptist church in Gary, Indiana, and African-Americans started moving into neighborhoods, right? They reroute the church bus, okay? This is that same church that the lady scooped me up and took me to. Great church in many ways it wasn't. They rerouted the church bus so it wouldn't go down those streets, pick up the little black kids, okay? And I'm like third grade, fourth grade. And I thought it was weird, okay? But I can't tell you that I stood up and said, this is wrong, okay, as a third grader. But I remember it. And it's like this early sense that, hey, the world is not just, it's dangerous out there. Now, we all know that. Everybody knows that it's not a fair, nice, beautiful world out there all the time, okay? But would you tell your life story so that you made a big deal out of that? Would you import this sense that the world is dangerous and unjust into the early chapters of your life story? And so I think, Paul, your theme is really right on target to where I want to go next time. The kinds of stories that highly generative adults tell actually are sort of surprising in some ways, the kinds of things they bring up. And so we'll talk a little bit about what those stories are next time and what they might mean. So I think I'm out of time. I'll wait to hear a bell, but thank you very much for coming.